Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. John Wallace's mother was a Strickland. Now, this might not mean a darn thing to you, but it meant everything to the folks of Meriwether County, Georgia, in the first part of the 20th century. The Stricklands owned 2,000 acres of hilly Georgia terrain on which they raised dairy cattle and grew cotton and corn. The cotton was a solid cash crop. The corn was good for making whiskey. The dairy cattle were a fine cover for the moonshine distribution system they had working. Milk jugs don't always have to carry milk, that stretched all the way to New York and Chicago. The Stricklands' massive farm had been known as the Kingdom for 150 years, and it mattered a great deal who was king. Old Man John Strickland, the most violent ever OG, died in a gun battle in 1932. It was his choice, I guess, because he chose to pull his two fancy mother-of-pearl-handled revolvers from his holster instead of sticking up his hands when asked by the Internal Revenue men who had been staking out one of his most productive stills. Among the IRS men that day, and the one most likely to have killed the old man, was the legendary G-man and ace tracker of the backwoods of Georgia, a man named Elsie Hancock. We'll get back to Elsie in a minute, but what's important to know right now is that while the Strickland family strongman, who controlled the county, its sheriff, and a moonshine operation, died, the consensus choice of successor now was his sister's son, John Wallace. John, they knew, could and would expand the family's sphere of influence, as well as the family's reign of terror, while the rest of the nation was suffering through the Depression. John Posey, who runs a few tours in the area, explains.
And when the price of cotton rose, people wanted to make some form of money, and the only problem that they had, the government with this, was that they weren't getting the taxes from the moonshine. And so folks like John Wallace really rose to power in this part of the country.
Wallace wasn't the most likely next in line. That would have been John Strickland's son, Tom, but he wasn't seen as right for the job. Margaret Ann Barnes, a reporter for the Noonan Times Herald and the author of Murder in Coweta County, explains why in the book. Quote, Tom, a tall, dark, sinister figure, had the necessary cruelty and lack of conscience to commit whatever deed was required to maintain family dominance, but his character was flawed by a tendency to break under pressure. Leadership required a cool detachment, an ability to function effectively under the most formidable circumstances. Tom Strickland didn't have it. John Wallace did. End quote. So John Wallace was the newly appointed king. He would soon become even better than his uncle had been at this game because, as townsfolk told it, he learned how to garner goodwill and how to store that for when he needed it. Narrator, writer, and researcher Paula Miller made Murder Most Southern, a folksy mini-doc about the Stricklands, John Wallace, and an unrelated sharecropper named Wilson Turner. Here she is talking about Wallace.
Everybody loved him. He was charming, he was kind, and always there to help people out. always given to the local church. He was part of the Methodist church, and he bought pews and all sorts of stuff. But once again, everybody knew not to cross him. They said, one person was quoted, one of his friends was quoted as saying he was good as gold unless you crossed him.
Suffice to say, this is a story about how Wilson Turner didn't get the memo, and how John Wallace didn't forget a slight, and how that confluence would set off one of the most remarkable murder investigations in Georgia history. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Hims.
At some point, you stop blaming stress, bad sleep, or just getting older. If bedroom performance has been an issue, you've probably thought about doing something, but maybe didn't want to deal with the hassle of making an appointment or standing in a pharmacy line.
That's exactly what Hims takes off the table. It's completely online. You complete a simple intake, a licensed provider reviews your information, and if treatment is right for you, it ships to your door in discreet packaging.
That includes Sildenafil, the generic for Viagra, available through Hims at up to 95% less than the brand name. And if that's not the right fit, there are additional treatment options available. It's straightforward, transparent, and designed to make getting care feel easy.
To get simple online access to personalized, affordable care for ED, weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/COTC. That's hims.com/COTC for your free online visit, hims.com/COTC.
Prescription required. See website for details and important safety information. Sildenafil is a generic version of Viagra. Viagra is a registered trademark of Viatris Specialty LLC. Hims is not affiliated with or endorsed by Viatris.
Wilson Turner should have known better. Even Turner's young wife, Julia, had an uncle who told Wilson that working for John Wallace was a lifetime commitment. If he employed you, said the uncle, he figured he owned you. Fact was, even if you weren't employed by him and if you lived in Meriwether County, you were still subject to his rules and his whims. Still, when Wilson Turner saw the whole Wallace setup, the farm, the crops, the moonshine operation, he wanted in. But hold up a minute, there's something you ought to know about Turner before we go on. He had come from nothing, yet he was born wanting more. He had left Roberta, Georgia, a small town near Macon, to serve in the army as a mechanic during the Second World War. While home on leave in 1942, Turner decided he had no desire to go back, so he took his brother's 4F draft card, 4F being a designation for being unfit for duty, and switched identities with him. The brother, who was mentally challenged, was the real Wilson Turner. His army-dodging brother was named William, but assumed the name Wilson from that point on and went about his business, free from the U.S. military's clutches. Even his wife didn't know his real name when they wed on April 11, 1944. To make things easier for me, and because everything ever written about him, including some court documentation, refers to him as Wilson, so will I. Now, as I said, Wilson Turner married, and the couple moved to Meriwether County because Julia's uncle Millard had offered to help them out. A thin and frail man, Turner persuaded Wallace to set him up as a sharecropper on Kingdom land. Turner was slight, but muscled. He was a hard worker, something Wallace appreciated. He was so good and so reliable, in fact, that after just 5 months, Wallace let Turner in on his moonshine operation as a hauler, which paid well. Things were good for the next 2.5 years. Then, one night, Sheriff Hardy Collier, who was also in Wallace's pocket, informed the boss that IRS agents had found Wallace's most active still and were planning to raid it that night. Wallace's response was to shut the thing down, leave all 400 gallons of it behind for the revenue men to find and destroy. Turner couldn't believe his ears. He had 20 gallons of the stuff already loaded in his brand new pickup truck. An extravagance, for sure, and he needed the money to make the payments. Besides, he now had a new baby at home. He told Wallace he would take the chance and run it himself. Wallace reluctantly agreed, figuring it would be a good lesson for the youngster to get caught, pay the price, come back smarter. Wallace himself had done short stints in prison twice for making liquor and skirting the tax. But Turner didn't get caught. He reported back to Wallace that the 20 gallons had made it through. Wallace expected to see the cash that Turner had made on that night's run. Turner blanched. He had taken the risk. Wallace's plan had been to bail. This was his money. So Turner heartily declined, then tried to walk away. Wallace, angry and disrespected, went after him immediately, pummeling him into submission, taking the money off him, and holding him down. It was then he directed his two black still foremen, Albert Brooks and Robert Lee Gates, to explain to Turner how things worked in the kingdom. You did what you were told. It was all Wallace's money. Wallace then told Turner to get off his property, quote, before I decide to kill you instead, end quote. Later, he told quite a few people that he would have killed Turner on the spot, but Turner's wife and baby were watching. Now, I hate to interrupt the narrative, but I do feel like I should say a word about the quotes I'm using in this episode. I'm usually meticulous about verbatim quotes. I make every effort to make them as accurate as possible. In this case, I confess I can't tell how accurate they are. Barnes' book is a main source. It was written in 1976 and includes no citations. Because Barnes was a journalism student at the University of Georgia during this whole mess and then became a reporter in Coweta County, I am assuming she had notes or documents that support the quotes. I'm also assuming she checked sources and verified conversations. But I don't feel as comfortable as I do with other sources, given the lack of citations. I will say, though, that none of the quotes feel out of place. In all cases, the language and sentiment fit the occasion and match the language and sentiment I see elsewhere in newspaper reports. But back to Wilson Turner and his ill-advised decision to cross John Wallace. From that point on, Turner was effectively blackballed in Meriwether County. The man couldn't find work. The corn and cotton in his fields went untended, and he was out of that nice house that Wallace provided his sharecroppers, and wouldn't you know it, Julia was pregnant again. A man had to do something. Wallace owed him. So sometime in early April of 1948, Turner decided he would steal a few of Wallace's prized Guernseys, take them to another county, sell them as his own, and they'd be even. He figured Wallace had so many cows, he would never notice the three were gone. Turner convinced a reluctant Uncle Millard and Tommy Windham, one of Julia's brothers, to help him out. Wallace, of course, noticed immediately. He then alerted every sheriff in the adjacent counties, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, livestock agents, and slaughterhouses of the theft. The cows were found, and law enforcement set up a trap to capture the three men when they went to move the cows to other locations. Carrollton Chief of Police Rada Threadgill followed up a Wallace tip and nabbed Turner in the act and took him to jail, which Turner viewed as a mixed blessing. Sure, he was arrested, but he knew Wallace didn't control Threadgill, who's still known as a stand-up lawman. So, Turner had reason to feel lucky that of all the lawmen searching for him, Threadgill was the one who found him. But that good luck didn't hold. In the middle of the first night in jail, Turner was awakened by Meriwether Sheriff Hardy Collier, who told him he was being moved to the Meriwether County Jail. The crime had happened there. Sheriff Threadgill didn't like it, but legally, Collier had jurisdiction. Turner fought with every fiber in his being. He screamed for help and kicked at the deputies. Then he realized that John Wallace was waiting outside to drive Turner's pickup back with him to Greenville, the county seat. Collier's little helper. Once in the Meriwether County Jail, Turner was offered no phone call and no way to tell his wife where he was or how long he would be detained. Everyone was doing what they'd been told to. Turner again tried screaming for help through his jail window. If anyone noticed, they were told he was drunk and to ignore him. But, afraid for his life now, he needed to get word out to those who might rescue him. He thought he might ask the jail trustee, a black man named Jake, to help him. Using a small nub of a pencil that he found in his pocket, he wrote a note on three pieces of cigarette paper and was for his wife's brother, James. He asked James to find Julia and get some money. He apologized for being in jail and said it wouldn't happen again. The trustee, Jake, declined to deliver the message, and Turner stuffed the undelivered note in his pocket. On April 20th, a little bit before noon, Jake returned to tell Turner that he was being let go. The so-called assistant jailer, a Mrs. Vivian Matthews, who was more cook and maid than jailer, had told Jake that there wasn't enough to hold Turner on and gave him instructions for the release. Jake also told Turner that his pickup was out front and the keys were in it. Turner remembered that it had been full of gas when he was arrested, so nothing could stop him from driving straight out of the county to start over with his family somewhere else. But Turner had forgotten where he was. When he walked outside to his waiting truck, he saw something that reminded him. Here's John Posey again, the internet host who takes followers on a video tour of the places that matter in this case.
Well, as he's looking back, he sees that this wall that obstructs his view from the jail is concealing John Wallace and his men. And John Wallace couldn't have asked for a more perfect ambush site. If you look at this old records building, it perfectly obstructs the view of anybody heading down from the direction of the old Meriwether County Jail. And he's waiting for him right there on the courthouse steps. So Turner, understandably very freaked out, hops in his car and heads to Coweta County, passing the jail that he was held in for 2 days.
Turner headed north to Coweta County up Highway 27. He may have planned to get all the way to Atlanta, just 60 miles away. Then Turner noticed that his gas tank was near empty. It had been drained. He knew his life was on the line. John Wallace and whoever it was in the car that was following him were set on killing him. He'd have to chance it. If he could get to Coweta County, he'd be safe. Maybe jailed, but safe. Because Coweta County had something that was better than 1,000 friends waiting to help. It had Sheriff Lamar Potts. And Sheriff Potts was the best kind of lawman. He didn't care who you were, you got treated equal. He cared if he broke the law, of course, but he believed that had to be proved rightfully. He also believed that everybody deserved protection from vigilantes, even up until you got executed, if it came to that. For that and 1,000 other reasons, his county boasted the lowest crime rate in the state. Turner had no choice. His truck was now flying on fumes toward the county line. Behind him, Wallace Yes Man Herring Savelle was pushing the gas pedal down on his Ford sedan while Wallace himself was leaning out the car window, shooting wildly at Turner's car while it was still within Meriwether County bounds. He knew about Lamar Potts, too. Crimes of Centuries is sponsored by Talkiatry. If you've ever tried to find a psychiatrist who takes your insurance, you already know how frustrating it can be. Months-long wait lists, providers not accepting new patients. Talkiatry is built to fix exactly that.
Talkiatry is a 100% online psychiatry practice. You're seeing a medical provider who can actually diagnose conditions like ADHD, anxiety, depression, and more, and prescribe medication when it's appropriate. That's different from a therapy-only platform.
Tell them about the insurance.
All 800-plus clinicians are in-network with major insurers, so you're using your existing insurance, not paying out-of-pocket or into some expensive subscription. You complete a short online assessment, get matched with a clinician who fits your needs, and you can have your first visit scheduled in days, not months.
More than 300,000 patients have already found care through Talkiatry. Head to talkiatry.com/COTC to complete the short assessment and get matched with an in-network psychiatrist in just a few minutes.
That's talkiatry.com/COTC to get matched in minutes.
The two-car caravan became a three-car parade when Henry Mobley's car joined in the chase. Henry was another of those men in town who owed Wallace. His car also carried Wallace's cousin, Tom Strickland. The men were there to help with matters, if they got out of hand, and to provide alibis or alternative versions of events if necessary. brought in my hand, who ran a gas station and did Wallace's auto maintenance, was also supposed to be in on the murderous caper, but his wife put her foot down. He was a no-show, earning the mark of a man who would not go far in Meriwether County now. In any case, Wallace knew others he had counted on had also screwed up that day. Turner was supposed to have been released exactly at noon. The plan to kill him, to have everyone in the right place, depended on that careful timing. But somehow, Turner was out before the noon hour. Heads would roll. And he must have wondered, why did Turner's truck have any gas in it? He had instructed Sheriff Collier very clearly that he was to drain the tank completely. All these mistakes were to make Wallace angrier and more reckless. So he continued to try and shoot at the swerving vehicle just ahead in broad daylight. Bystanders be damned. Still, the car he was in couldn't seem to overtake Turner's new truck. But they were closing. They were just 10 feet behind Turner when the truck shot past the county line. A few hundred yards ahead, the Sunset Tourist Camp, a small cafe and store that handled bookings for overnight on-site parking, offered gas for the weary traveler. Turner pulled in, got out of the truck, and began running toward the safety of the cafe, screaming that he was about to be killed. Behind him, four men fell out of their cars to jump on the small man. The two men in the first car were armed with a sawed-off shotgun and a pearl-handled revolver. They were yelling that the man had escaped from jail and was wanted for murder. Life around the Sunset Tourist Camp, busy only a minute before, came to the front porch and watched as the four men managed to get hold of Turner and drag him to Savelle's sedan. Turner wasn't going without a fight. He somehow wedged himself firmly outside the car with his feet on the door opening such that his legs wouldn't bend and he couldn't be forced to comply. It was then that Wallace slammed Turner hard on the back of his head with the butt of his gun. The gun discharged and Turner slumped in a spray of blood as he was forcibly shoved into the back of the car. And off they went, as shocked witnesses watched them continue to pound on the broken man in the back seat. They were headed back to Meriwether County. Steve Smith, proprietor of the tourist camp, immediately called Sheriff Lamar Potts and reported that he and his customers and neighbors may have just witnessed a murder. He had even gotten a partial plate. Potts got there fast and started asking questions. Turner's truck was still in the lot. It was completely out of gas. Potts's only deputy was his brother, J.H., and he was in Atlanta on business just then. He knew he needed help now, so he called the state police and asked if Sergeant J.C. Otwell could assist. A young man, Otwell was solid and shared Potts's commitment to justice. They took witness statements and they found who owned the truck. It had been sold locally not so long ago and could be traced to Wilson Turner. Witness descriptions of the man who had been taken away fit Turner. The witness descriptions of the so-called deputies who had manhandled him so viciously fit the description of Wallace and a few of his cohorts. And Potts knew that Wallace had reported his cows being stolen by Turner about a week earlier. He called Carrollton County and found out that Turner had been transferred to the Meriwether County Jail 2 days earlier. Potts called Sheriff Collier in Meriwether County to ask if he knew anything about a jailbreak or the guys who had been after the alleged escapee. Sounding nonchalant, Collier is reported to have said, "I have no knowledge of such a thing." Let's just say Potts knew better. The sheriff knew that he had to be calmly and carefully methodical in his approach now to what he figured might be a complicated and dangerous investigation. The sheriff of another county might have aided and abetted in the public and quite wanton murder of a citizen whose only crime was stealing cows. He wasted no time in finding some highway department workers who had seen two Ford sedans chasing the truck earlier in the day, but only saw one car return about 40 minutes later. The cars had split up. One was obviously carrying Turner. Potts doubted the man was still alive. At the end of that first day, the sheriff had to put out every feeler he knew to. He had also taken care to handle two other pressing matters. One was to buy a new pair of pants for a local kiddo he had seen walking to school in too short and too tight breeches. The other was to answer a widow's request for him to find out what that noise was coming from her barn. It was a banging door that needed to be latched. It sounds too idyllic to be true, but that's the kind of sheriff he was. Even today, stories about Sheriff Potts circulate. Here's current Carrollton Police Chief Joel Richards.
My grandfather knew Lamar Potts, the sheriff, and he just talked about that Lamar would come over and hang out on the porch, and that I just remember my family always saying that Sheriff Potts was a man of integrity.
Anyway, the morning after Turner's capture, the Bureau of Motor Vehicles called back and told Sheriff Potts the name of the man who owned the car that had hauled Turner away from the Sunset Tourist Camp. It was Herring Savelle. A county over, Sheriff Collier was now dodging Potts' calls while he and Wallace tried to figure out what to do next. They knew Potts was like a dog with a bone. He would not let this thing go. Always in charge, Wallace told his law enforcement pal not to worry too much. If Potts had no body, there could be no murder charge. Georgia law was clear on that point. And Wallace knew what Potts didn't. Turner was dead and buried. He'd been dead before Savelle's car left Coweta County. Wallace had taken charge of the mess once they got across county lines and Savelle's car had blown a tire. They transferred Turner to the other sedan, the one driven by Mobley and carrying Strickland. Together, the three men had gone back to the vast wasteland that Wallace owned and found an abandoned well. Really, just a gaping hole in the earth, hidden in all that scrubby woods and random swamp. Wallace had slung the dead man over his shoulder, carried him a short way, then flung him into the well. For good measure, he had rolled a large, heavy rock over the lip of the well. He heard it crash down and onto what remained of the man's head. But talking the whole thing over with Collier the next day, Wallace found himself second-guessing the security of that well. In fact, he had spent the morning trying to locate the well so he could move the body to someplace safer. And he had trouble finding it. And while he couldn't, he knew, or fretted, that it was findable by someone else. So, he did the only thing he could think of. It was time to go talk to Mahaley Lancaster again. Perhaps it'd be best now to say that 1948 Georgia was, in some ways, not yet of the century it found itself in. The presence of the stereotypical boss hog obviously held, as did a persistent, side-by-side staunch belief in both the truth of the Bible and the infallibility of backwoods, quasi-witch-delivered prophecy. Mahaley was the quasi-witch in that previous sentence. She, more than once, proclaimed herself an oracle of the ages, a mystic who, with only one good eye, could see more than you and farther than you into the future. She lived in Heard County, a county adjacent to Coweta County as you continue on Highway 27. She was renowned and quite popular. Her price for any reading, curse, or vision was a dollar and a dime. The dollar was for her use, the dime fed the dog. She had just told Wallace a week or two earlier that Wilson Turner was the cow snatcher, that the cows would be found, and that Turner would be caught. The story goes that even before Wallace sat down the second time, she had asked if he had killed him. When Wallace asked how she knew that he had, she reportedly said the fire had told her. And she also knew that he had come that day to ask for her help because he had lost the body. Sally Toole, a native of the region and related to Mahaley by marriage, outlined the conversation between the Oracle and Wallace that happened that day.
And this time she told him in the third well that he looked in, he would find the package that she knew was Wilson Turner's. She told him, "I told you not to kill that man. I told you not to kill that man. You're going to pay for this, John Wallace. You'll pay."
Wallace allegedly balked at that last pronouncement. He'd find that body and destroy it for good. She took his money, but warned that it would make no difference. He said it would. She said, "It most certainly would not." Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Mint Mobile. We're now knee-deep in summer, traveling, living our best lives, and one thing I've been thinking about is how much people overpay for wireless without even questioning it. My friend John switched to Mint Mobile and won't stop talking about how happy he is. And I get it. When people hear that Mint Mobile plans are only $15 a month, the first question is always, what's the catch?
Right, that sounds too good to be true.
That's what I thought. But there isn't one. No gimmicks or gotchas. Unlimited talk, text, and data on the nation's largest 5G network. You can bring your current phone and your number. And it's a great option if you're thinking about adding a line for a kiddo, too. At $15 a month, it just makes sense.
And you choose your plan up front?
Yep, 3, 6, or 12-month plans. Say goodbye to a monthly bill. Sign up online. Totally easy.
To get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/COTC. That's mintmobile.com/COTC. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/COTC. That's it. There's no catch.
$45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Early the next morning, Coweta Sheriff Lamar Potts asked Meriwether Sheriff Hardy Collier to bring John Wallace to his office. By noon, when nothing had happened, Potts decided he would find Wallace himself. He took State Police Sergeant Otwell with him. The two men went first to the jail, no luck. Then to the Courthouse Square coffee shop Wallace frequented, still no luck. Potts noticed people were afraid to talk to him. When he asked for directions to Wallace's home, people were vague. The two lawmen found the place anyway, and nobody was home. Curious. It was time for Potts to go back to Coweta County and get a warrant for Wallace and Savelle's arrests. Savelle was hiding out, apparently, buying time. Wallace wasn't findable either, as he was visiting Mahaley's outside the county that morning. By late afternoon, he was back, but was in the process of implementing his plan to once and for all rid himself of Wilson Turner. He gathered up two of his most trusted liquor foremen, Albert Brooks and Robert Lee Gates. Both black men had worked for Wallace for as long as they could remember and had long ago learned that loyalty, such as it was the only way to stay alive and keep their families safe from harm. Even when they both had to go to prison for transporting moonshine, they had not given up the big boss, and he had repaid the favor by offering them extra work for extra money. Make no mistake, they were still field hands, but they were favored. Wallace even took pains to make sure their children were better outfitted and better fed than any other farmhands that worked the kingdom. Tonight, Wallace told the two men they'd have to help him with something. They had no choice. On his instructions, they filled some heavy milk cans with gasoline, put some cordwood in a truck, and found some well drags to bring along. They also saddled up a draft horse. The three men set off. The two laborers had no idea what they were looking for or what they were going to do with it when they found it. When they asked, Wallace said they had to find a, quote, good-sized package, end quote. The trio searched the woods until almost dawn, turning up nothing of interest to Wallace, even after digging out two wells they had come upon. Exhausted, Wallace decided to consult an old farmer who knew the woods better than he did. He gave them directions to a third well. They trod on. At one point, they had to leave the horse as the ground was too precarious to risk it. But the three men persisted. And then, here at last, Wallace saw the familiar well and knew Mahaley had been right again. He told Albert and Robert Lee to look in the well. It was dark, but not too dark to miss what was in that well. They spotted Wilson Turner, the little man who had tried to cheat their boss out of his rightful moonshine profits and a few cows. Horrified to the point of shaking, the two men were now tasked with pulling the waterlogged corpse out of the well. Nothing about it was easy. They tried to rope it, then yanked, tugged, dragged, and heaved until the package was clear of the well. Sickened by the process and aghast by what lay in front of them, they were now afraid of what was to come next. They wondered if Wallace would even let them live after they had done his bidding this time. Wallace told the men to wrap the package in a burlap sheet he had brought from home. He told them to take the axe and cut down a long pole and then tie the package to the pole. That way, the two men could each sling an end of the pole over a shoulder and carry the swinging, swaying body between them. When the men dared to ask Wallace what he was going to do with the body, he said they were going to burn it. This was the worst kind of sacrilege, at least to Robert Lee. God would not like this. The men walked on. When they got to the horse, they transferred the body to her for the carrying. Wallace knew he would need to cross a road with the body to get where he wanted to go, and planned that crossing would happen at noon, when all of his workers had gone home for a bite to eat. So far, all had gone well. No one had seen. They had to backtrack near a creek as the going was hard, the men hacking at the woods to clear a path for the horse and the dead weight of Wilson Turner. They arrived at an old site where a moonshine still once stood. They laid the body on the ground and covered it with brush. Wallace then told them to return to their fields and act as if everything was normal. He would see them just after sundown. It wasn't a request. Robert Brooks and Robert Lee Gates complied, showing up the still site where they started to build the base of the fire. Wallace said he had packed the wood himself for quick burning while they retrieved the body. The corpse was then draped across the wood. More wood was added to cover him. The whole pyre was then drenched in 10 gallons of gas from the milk jugs. Wallace told Albert and Robert Lee to take cover. He then stood a bit away from the pit and threw a lighted torch onto the pile. The fire detonated like a rocket, shooting flames 60 feet in the air. It had to have been heard a mile away. The forest reportedly shook. They watched until the fire burned fast and furiously to its finish. Albert and Robert Lee were told to come back the next morning to scrape out the pit, to gather up any ashes, and put them in the creek. Nothing should remain. The two men, of course, did as they were told. Wallace came very early that Friday to inspect their handiwork and found it highly satisfactory. But Robert Lee knew that he had crossed a terrible line with God. This was a pit that Wilson Turner had dug himself not that long ago during his short stint in the liquor business. And now Robert Lee and Albert had done something that would, he knew, ensure their eternal damnation. Maybe the law would forgive this, but not the Lord. He went back to look in on his cotton crop. Sheriff Collier had promised Sheriff Potts that he would bring both Wallace and Herring Savelle in at 9 a.m. on Friday. The surrender was to happen at the law office of a local attorney named Walt Sanders, who worked out of Noonan. It was a favor Sanders was doing for his friend, Meriwether County lawyer Gus Huddleston, who had been tapped by Wallace as his defense counsel. The accused men arrived late. When they did, Sanders asked what the holdup was, and the men explained they couldn't decide which car to bring as Savelle's had been cleaned, but there was still some blood in it. Sanders asked if this cleaning was done at a public service station. Why, yes, it was. Wallace rushed to calm the lawyer. Nothing was going to happen here. They'd be fine. Sheriff Collier had come with Wallace to the office. The lawyer asked why he was there. Collier said he was Wallace's alibi. They had been having lunch when the alleged murder occurred. Oh, for Pete's sake, the lawyer thought. This was worse than he had imagined. When Sheriff Potts met them all, he produced the warrants. They were explicitly for the kidnapping and murder of Wilson Turner. A cocksure Wallace answered back, "Where's the body?" Potts was ready to confront them with witnesses. They were ready to post bail and go home. "Can't do that," said Potts. "Your cars are being impounded for evidence. And besides, they were going to be held without bond." Gus Huddleston was rumored to have turned to Potts and said, quote, "I don't think you realize the situation. John Wallace is a man of position and prestige. He can't be kept in jail like an ordinary criminal. He's got too much money," end quote. Potts is said to have responded that Wallace's money was welcome to join him in jail. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Bioptimizers. I have been on a mission to actually sleep well. I've been reading about how during perimenopause and menopause, shifting hormones directly deplete the magnesium your nervous system depends on.
So magnesium is the missing piece?
Which is why I'm excited to try a magnesium breakthrough by Bioptimizers. It's in the mail to me right now. What drew me in is that this isn't just a trending brand. They're PhD formulated, backed by 20 plus years of research and over 15,000 lab tests.
Ooh, it says here that it's not just a standard magnesium supplement. It's an all-in-one complex with seven different forms of magnesium working together to support sleep, stress, energy, and recovery.
If you're ready to finally sleep great and feel like yourself again, head to bioptimizers.com/COTC and use the exclusive code COTC to get 15% off any order. You'll get great discounts, free gifts, and the peace of mind of never running out. And Bioptimizers backs it with a 365-day, no-questions-asked, money-back guarantee, a full year, zero risk. Because at the end of the day, Bioptimizers' mission is to empower everyone to live a stronger, longer, better life. And this is one of the best tools I've found to actually do that. Again, that's 15% off at bioptimizers.com/COTC when you use my code COTC. Make this the year you finally get your sleep, your energy, and yourself back. Sheriff Lamar Potts wasted no time lining up witnesses from the Sunset Tourist Camp, most specifically the owner, Brave Steve Smith. He had also searched John Wallace's home, finding bloody clothes, sheets, and towels. He didn't have a warrant to do it, but it was a legal search nonetheless. Wallace's much-beleaguered wife, Josephine, had given the sheriff permission. The blood that had dripped down onto the back of Wallace's khakis had been thick and viscous, indicative of where Turner's head might have laid when Wallace carried him that first day to the well. When asked about the bloody trousers, Wallace said the blood was from small scratches on his own hand. Potts took a picture of Wallace's barely nicked hands to show how ludicrous a claim that was. Potts sent the blood away to make sure it was human. It was. Deputy J.H. Potts found a blood-stained, pearl-handled revolver in the glove compartment of the car Savelle had driven to turn himself in. They also spoke to Julia Turner, who explained how no one would let her have access to her husband while he was in jail. This meant that Collier had been actively involved in the conspiracy to kill him. The case against the men was shaping up nicely, except for that one thing. Where was the body? To that end, Potts decided to search all 2,000 acres of the kingdom. He called the governor and asked if he might borrow some state police. He was told he could have as many as he wanted. The Georgia State Patrol, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, and the State Alcohol Tax Unit all offered up officers to help look. Potts even offered $500 of his own money as a reward. Still, no one in Meriwether County was talking. Then he heard that Wallace had paid a call to Mahaley Lancaster just before and just after Turner had disappeared. So Potts made a trip to Heard County to see the fortune teller himself. He asked her if Wallace had been there. She said, quote, "Once about a lost cow, once about a lost body," end quote. She wasn't as specific as he might have liked. Still, she tried to help, as Sally Toole explained.
When Sheriff Potts went to see Mahaley about the body of Wilson Turner, she told the sheriff she got very upset and said, "Fire, fire, fire." And she told him that John Wallace had burned the body of Wilson Turner, and that if he were to look in the creek, he would find what remains there were of that body.
Things were moving fast. Tommy Windham, Julia Turner's brother, came in to see Potts and confess his part in the cow snatching. Brought in My Hand, Wallace's mechanic, also came in. If you remember, his wife had kept him from participating in the grabbing of Turner and confessed what he knew. Specifically, that Henry Mobley had driven the other car. Now Mobley was put in jail. All of this was accomplished in a week. The Atlanta Journal and the Atlanta Constitution had come south to write about the hunt for the body a hunt that now drew something like 500 lawmen from around the state. Not a one was from Meriwether County. Through now rampant gossip and enlightened innuendo, Potts and his brother determined the fourth man in on the killing was Tom Strickland. They had considerable trouble trying to bring him in. Strickland had answered the door and then tried unsuccessfully to pull a gun on the sheriff, and after that, to unsuccessfully run when he saw the chance. His people had predicted this years earlier when they determined he wasn't the heir to his father's illegal business. He simply wasn't the man that Wallace was. Potts could work with that. The sheriff put him in the Noonan City Jail, apart from the others who were housed at the county jail. It took only a few hours for Strickland, alone, scared, and powerless, to fold. By his hysterical reaction, he was also likely very claustrophobic. Without much prompting, he told everything he knew, despite Potts's assurance that he would not get immunity for talking. He too would face trial for murder. Potts wanted the men held in the county lockup to know now that Strickland had talked. Soon, Herring Savelle talked too. He said he knew where the body was. He, like Strickland, gave a vague description of where the well might be located. Then he had a night to think about it, and summoning an attorney in the morning, Savelle recanted. It was time to call in Elsie Hancock. I told you we'd get back to this name. Hancock was the IRS agent that killed John Strickland in 1932. But more importantly, for this part of the story, he was also the best tracker in the South. He had been ill and missed a lot of the early searching for Wilson Turner's body, but by May 1st, he was out in the thick of the kingdom finding footprints, horse tracks, and broken branches. He knew, from fibers left on broken limbs, that a horse had been carrying something, and that something was wrapped in burlap. He told Potts he was making progress. The day after, Hancock followed the trail down to a creek, saw where three sets of seemingly male footprints had backtracked, and saw where they had climbed an embankment down to where it looked as if something had been laid and covered over. He was getting very close. Then, a man came forward to tell everything he knew. He had heard an explosion, he had seen a fire. That coincided with the fact that Robert Lee's wife had told others what her husband had told her, and now it was a secret no more. Potts had beat the bushes, and they'd yielded fruit. He rounded up Robert Lee Gates and Albert Brooks, and after significant assurances of their safety, both met up with Hancock and showed him where the fire pit was. The two men said they had done a mighty clean scrape and thrown the ashes in the nearby creek. Hancock looked and saw what Wallace had not. He spotted a few charred bone fragments. They were bagged and tagged. Then he went to the creek. At the water's edge, hung on a branch, he saw a floating bag. When he retrieved it, he found what the two field hands had tossed in: ashes and some more bone fragments. The Atlanta forensics folks identified them as human. They had a body, or something very close to one. Shortly thereafter, they had the gas cans, the well drags, the sapling pole, all of it. At the bottom of the well, which they had also been led to, they had found a large mass of brain matter. And they found a note written on cigarette paper that had obviously fallen from Wilson Turner's pocket when he was dumped there. It was to Julia's brother James, asking him to get Julia some money. Justice moves swiftly now. Robert Lee and Albert's families were taken out of Meriwether County. John Wallace continued to gloat that nobody would convict him, especially not on the word of two black witnesses. He also confidently said that, quote, "No one is going to convict me of killing white trash," end quote. The trial began in June of 1948. Wallace's lawyer argued that Turner didn't die in Coweta County, meaning the case should be handled in far friendlier Meriwether County, and when that failed, he argued the killing was accidental. Mahaley's testimony was riveting. The Atlanta Constitution wrote, Sorcery or science, Kawita asks which solves slaying of Turner. Rail thin and wearing a military-style service cap, the elderly Oracle was photographed inside her sister's rundown cabin with a deck of cards in her hands, her bad eye pinched closed. The trial turned out to be quite a show, as the Columbus Ledger reported. Quote, "The upstairs courtroom has been jammed each day and peanut salesmen are making a financial killing," end quote. It was deemed the most widely publicized legal battle in Georgia's history since the Leo Frank trial of 1913. See Season 1, Episode 1 for more on that case. John Wallace testified in his own defense. Under some agreement that allowed him to make a statement without the possibility of being cross-examined, he told an improbable story that no one could buy about what happened. Wallace said he had been reluctant to hire Turner, a white man, because he didn't want to mix black and white labor. But he made an exception because he thought Turner was a stand-up guy and he wanted to help him out. Then he heard that Turner was making illegal whiskey, and Wallace, the legendary bootlegger, said, "Wilson, I'm not going to have you making whiskey on my place. I've been in the penitentiary twice." See, Wallace had gone straight in this version of events. Still, he gave Turner another chance, and wouldn't you know it, Turner recruited Robert Lee Gates, the prosecution's star witness, to go into the liquor business with him. Wallace said he told Turner he didn't like that he was associated with, and I'm quoting here from the Atlanta Journal, "Negroes on a more or less social equality basis." He asked him to leave the place. Wallace admitted accosting Turner outside the cafe, but he said he had only hit him lightly with the shotgun before driving him around to locate his stolen cows. It was during that effort that Turner attacked him near the well his body was later found in. And even then, when Wallace fatally shot him, it wasn't on purpose. He was just shifting his gun from one arm to the other when it fired accidentally. He testified that he was so distraught, it took him 10 days before he managed to convince himself that Turner was actually dead. None of the evidence corroborated that story, though. The cigarette papers and the testimony of Gates and Brooks sealed his fate. On June 18, 1948, Wallace was found guilty and sentenced to death. Jim Bellows of the Ledger Enquirer wrote on the next day's front page, quote, "Big John Wallace was sentenced to die in the electric chair for the sensational killing of a young tenant farmer. It took a Coweta County jury only 1 hour and 9 minutes to convict the wealthy Meriwether County dairyman," end quote. It was rare in this period of Georgia history for two black witnesses to testify against a white man, period, much less for the jury to find their word more reliable than his. Soon after, Mobley, Savelle, and Strickland got life in prison. They would only serve 7 years. Sheriff Hardy Collier had also been charged with being accessory to murder. He was still working while awaiting trial, but on July 13, 1948, he died of a heart attack while making an arrest. Albert Brooks and Robert Lee Gates were both charged with accessory to murder as well, but were found not guilty. From prison, Wallace lodged appeals that he was certain would spare him a fate he never believed would befall him. Not in his state, not for this reason. On November 3rd, 1950, he was duly executed by the state of Georgia. And yet, a 5-mile stretch of road is named after the man in rural Meriwether County. John Wallace Road is named after the one-time kingpin. Doug Richards, a reporter for Atlanta's WXIA-TV, went to Meriwether County in 2015 to ask why a county road was named after an executed murderer. There, he happened upon Mike Strickland, a great-great-nephew of John Wallace. He asked Strickland if he was proud of his uncle.
I am, yeah. I think he looked after what was on.
Asked if Wallace had been framed, he replied,
"No, he wasn't framed. He was just doing what anybody else would have done at the time. That man come back down here and stole both his dairy cows. Do you think he needed doing away with?"
"Well, it seems pretty harsh."
"John only messed up one thing. No, it wasn't harsh in that day. Man, you're talking about 1949. Everybody wore two pistols on the hip. Need to get back that way today.
Everybody has their heroes, I guess. Many have chosen Potts instead to celebrate as a folk hero for the state. A few still point to Mahaley Lancaster for that honor. The murder in Coweta County got the Movie of the Week treatment in 1983. It starred bad boy Johnny Cash as Sheriff Potts and good guy Andy Griffith as killer John Wallace. You can still watch it online or on streaming services today. It was Barnes who summarized the impact of the case. It served to shatter the belief that there would always be, quote, those who were above the law, those who were beyond the law, and those who were at the mercy of the law, end quote. It aptly demonstrated how some men, powerful, narcissistic, bullying men, think they're above it. That is, until braver men prove them wrong. To research this case, journalist Amy Wilson read Murder in Coweta County by Margaret Ann Barnes. She also read the Noonan Times Herald and Atlanta newspapers reporting on the case in real time. She watched the 1983 movie Murder in Coweta County starring Cash and Griffith. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Head to www.grabbagcollab.com for exclusive content related to this show and access to other series on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and sometimes my child, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, please help us out by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts. Also, tell your friends. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're @centuriespod, and you can find us on the Crimes of the Centuries Facebook page.